This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, lots of questions over Russian airstrikes in Syria. A massive trade deal reached by 12 Pacific Rim countries. Sitting could be bad for your health.
What we found is that 10 minutes of walking at a normal pace, which is equivalent to about 1,000 steps, was sufficient to reverse vascular dysfunction associated with sitting.
A new movie with a big name tackles survival on Mars. These stories and more just ahead. I'm Ray Kugel. NATO, Turkey, and the United States have denounced Russian violations of Turkish airspace and Moscow's bid to fight terrorism and back the government of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg says the Russian airstrikes are not contributing to the security and stability of the region. The U.S. State Department on Monday called the intrusions reckless and provocative, and Russian military involvement a strategic mistake. Dorian Jones reports Turkey scrambled its own warplanes as Russian jets struck targets along the Turkish-Syrian border.
Turkish government officials say the country's military radar locked on to the Russian jet and Turkish Air Force F-16 fighters were scrambled to intercept it. A Turkish official quoted in the media said its jets would have engaged, but the Russian plane returned to Syrian airspace. Under current rules of engagement, Turkish forces can attack any warplane operating from Syria that breaches its airspace. Turkish Prime Minister Ahmet Davutoğlu warned Russia against future violations. Let me put it bluntly, Davutoğlu said. Turkey's rules of engagement are valid for Syria's, Russia's or another country's warplanes. He added that whoever violates Turkish airspace will be subject to the necessary actions. Until recently, Turkey and Russia have enjoyed close relations, aided by what observers describe as good chemistry between the presidents. But with Ankara and Moscow backing rival sides in the Syrian civil war, tensions have been rising. Dorian Jones of VOA News, Istanbul.
Russia first launched its air attacks last week and said they were aimed at Islamic State targets. Regional analyst Joseph Ulmert, a political science professor at the University of South Carolina, told International Edition's Victor Beatty he believes Russian strategy is to broaden the territory controlled by Mr. Assad's forces prior to any political solution.
We have to understand the basic fact that there is no one Syria anymore. There is not going to be one Syria again. We talk here about a campaign by the allies of Bashar Assad to save him and what's left of his regime and Alawite community. Right now, what happens is that they are trying to enlarge the enclave that is dominated by the Alawite community and the Syrian regime. If they will move on to other parts of Syria, that remains to be seen. But the aerial campaign will not put an end to ISIS, nor will it put an end to other rebel Islamic Sunni groups in Syria. That's the lesson of all kinds of conflicts that were before in the Middle East, including the Israeli attacks on Hezbollah in 2006, in retaliation to what they did to Israel and the Gaza campaign. So what Bashar Assad basically saying is, they're going to save me. Of course, he links it to the rest of the Middle East. That's an exaggeration to say it very mildly.
Russia again targeted what they claim were Islamic State targets, but others question whether or not they're IS targets or they're part of the Free Syrian Army, which is quote-unquote a moderate alternative to the Assad regime. What do you think their endgame is, Russia is?
What they're doing is very simple. If they attack targets at homes, they don't attack ISIS. ISIS is not based at homes. At homes, there are Sunni rebel groups, whether it is the Free Syrian Army or the Jaishul Islam, the Army of Islam, or any of those groups. The Russian game, as far as I can see, is to enlarge the enclave of the Alawites, to stretch it beyond what it is today, and to lift the basically siege that exists today on this enclave, because the rebels control the high roads from Homs to the north. So they basically cut off Damascus from, or at least they are endangering a cut off of Damascus from the Alawite enclave along the, along the coast in the northwestern part of Syria. So that's what the Russians are doing now. And I emphasize the word now because it remains to be seen whether it will be the end game or they will use whatever success they have now, if they have any, in order to try and drive rebel groups out of other territories of Syria.
Apparently what Russia is doing in Syria is playing very well at home. The Associated Press says it proves to Russian people that Moscow is showing up the U.S. and reclaiming its rightful place as a global power.
Well, that's a great point that you make. Well, of course, Russian public opinion, I mean, you know, we don't need to be too much impressed with Russian-oriented reports about how other people like what's happening. If there will be coffins with bodies of Russian soldiers, not that I wish it to happen, return to Moscow, there will be a change there. But the point really is that throughout the Syrian crisis, the Russians definitely targeted Syria as an example of what would not be what they call Pax Americana. That's very true. Whether Russia can really reclaim its previous status as a superpower comparable to the U.S., I doubt it very much. But they are identifying what they perceive to be a sign of weakness in American policy, and they entering what seems to be a vacuum created by the lack of decisive American policy.
Professor Olmert says if Moscow is perceived as going after the entire Sunni opposition to the Assad regime, that could have serious policy implications in its relations with countries like Saudi Arabia and Turkey. Social media is buzzing over the action in Syria. G. Abby Lee joins us with an update. Hi, G.
Hi, Ray.
The situation in Syria isn't getting any better, is it, G?
You're right, and the signs are pretty clear on Twitter. Many news outlets and journalists are tweeting about the ISIL's attack on Palmyra and the Russian airstrikes in the country. The London-based newspaper The Economist tweeted a link to one of its articles, and the piece details the danger of Russia's intervention in Syria and America's involvement in Afghanistan. In addition to the link, it wrote, "Putin dares, Obama dithers, Syria suffers." Now, that tweet seemed to resonate with many Twitter users who say it's an accurate description of what's happening in the region.
Well, that's kind of unfortunate.
Mm-hmm.
But did either President Obama or President Putin do any tweeting about Syria?
President Obama didn't, and neither did the official Kremlin news account at KremlinRussia_E. But the U.S. Embassy in Syria did tweet a quote from the president. The embassy is on Twitter at U.S. Embassy Syria, and the tweet reads like this. POTUS says, "We reject Russia's theory that everybody opposed to Assad is a terrorist." Now that's, of course, referring to Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, who views groups opposed to his government as terrorists. Russia is on the same page as Assad, and the West isn't.
Absolutely. In fact, Washington at one point promised aid to the Free Syrian Army.
Exactly. And if you want to learn more about the dynamics in Syria, you can check out an infographic created by the Financial Times. It's on Twitter at FT, and the image shows what the U.S., Russia, and Iran are supporting and opposing in the Syrian conflict. Ray?
Social media reporter G. Abby Lee. And you can follow her on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. That's JEEABBEYLEE. This is VOA.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. The United States and 11 other Pacific Rim nations reached final agreement Monday on a broad free trade deal that will cut taxes and reduce trade barriers – for almost half of the world's economy. The pact must still be ratified by national legislatures throughout the 12-country bloc for it to take effect. The completion of the deal is considered a major foreign policy victory for President Barack Obama. The Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP, was completed in the southern U.S. city of Atlanta, Georgia, the culmination of several years of often contentious negotiations. VOA economics writer Ken Bredemeyer joined International Edition's Jim Stevenson for a chat about the pact and its implications.
Well, at this point, the negotiations had gone on so long, and they had gotten down into the nitty-gritty of disagreements between various countries. It wasn't that all of them couldn't agree. It was usually one or two that were at odds with each other. It may have been dairy products, automobile rules about what constitutes a manufacturer of a car inside of a country. So a lot of things had to come together to get to the point of finally reaching an agreement. This is a big victory for President Barack Obama, who had espoused this law, had authority to get to a deal, and that's what he wanted to get done.
And this is essentially a free trade deal within the Asia-Pacific region.
Right. There are 12 countries, Japan, the U.S., Canada, Chile, Peru, several Southeast Asian countries. A notable exception, China is not part of it. And most economic analysts view this deal as a means for the U.S. and Japan to counter the big economic influence of China. China's the second largest economy in the world. Maybe it will join this pact at some point, but certainly not for the foreseeable future.
Now, interesting, the political support here in the United States usually is divided among partisan lines, Republicans and Democrats. President Obama, of course, a Democrat as president. But this time the Republicans basically sided with the president.
That's the business-oriented party in the U.S., generally associated with Republicans. There are exceptions, of course, but by and large, Democrats opposed this deal, and the reason is that they fear that American jobs will be lost. Democrats in the U.S. are often aligned with unions, and unions are pretty much uniformly against free trade, figuring that American workers are hurt.
VOA economics writer Ken Bredemeyer speaking with International Edition's Jim Stevenson. China, the world's second largest economy, decided not to join the trade pact as it pursues its own economic agenda. But U.S. officials have said the Chinese are welcome to become a partner whenever they think the time is right. Amid the completion of the TPP, global markets rose. Alexis Christophers joins us from the VOA New York Bureau to tell us why.
U.S. stocks surged toward the longest rally of the year as traders bank on the Federal Reserve to keep interest rates lower for longer following a somewhat weak jobs report for September. That boosted assets from commodities to emerging markets. The Standard & Poor's 500 index extended its rally to more than 5.5% over 5 days. Equities are, of course, recovering from a rout sparked by concern that slowing growth in China will spread to Europe and America. At the same time, the Fed is considering tightening monetary policy for the first time in 9 years. Data indicated the pace of growth in U.S. services industries cooled last month from the best readings in a decade. Meantime, oil rose above $46 a barrel after data showed a reduction in the number of rigs drilling for crude in the U.S., signaling output cuts in the world's biggest consumer.
Meanwhile, Alexis says former Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke does not think the U.S. economy is ready for a 1% interest rate hike.
The former Fed chairman says he sees no reason why central bank policymakers should rush to increase interest rates. He said it is not evident that monetary policy is too easy because inflation is so low and full employment is only starting to emerge. Bernanke refused to second-guess current Fed chair Janet Yellen on her decision not to increase rates at the Fed September meeting. He called it a, quote, tough call and said Friday's weak employment report for last month was a negative. The China slowdown, he says, has been broadly anticipated. anticipated because of Beijing's move to more of a consumer-driven economy. He said the open question is whether the economy there is slowing more than one would expect after such a transition. Bernanke argued investors should not get too worried about the recent problems in Chinese stocks because he said the market there does not relate too much to the economy.
VOA business correspondent Alexis Christophers in New York. A new study finds that a significant number of Americans surveyed are concerned about how charities spend their money. Stacey Palmer is editor of the Chronicle of Philanthropy. She spoke with International Edition Susan Yockey about the results and what participants felt about charity finances.
They're very worried about how charities spend their money, and especially whether they're paying their chief executives too much. So I think this constant drumbeat of executive pay being higher in some cases than the president of the United States has really hit the public the wrong way.
How did they get that information?
A lot of newspapers like to cover that information, and that's all public information. You can find that on the charity's tax return. So it's very easy to see how much nonprofit officials are paid.
Did they feel like the money was being well used?
They feel that charities do a good job of helping people, but still a rather large number say that they don't think that charities are doing a super job of helping others. And I think that was one of the most striking things we found, is that we expected that people would have concerns about how charities spend their money, but we expected them to get higher ratings on the fact that, you know, how they actually serve people and do the job of helping others.
How does that compare to past figures?
It's about the same, and that was another thing that surprised us. The helping people figure has actually dropped in terms of strong confidence, but the overall confidence figures are about the same. And you would expect that it should be improving, because certainly charities have had more work to do after the recession. I think that we should have seen higher figures.
Well, what about charities proving their successfulness or their effectiveness? This is a little controversial.
Yes, one of the things that people said they care a lot about, and the highest thing they said they look for, is that charities show evidence that they're making a difference. And one of the things that charities have struggled with is, how do they keep their administrative costs low, which is what the public says they want to do, and still do lots of great measurement of whether their programs are making a difference. So I think some people in the charity world see a bit of a contradiction, that donors aren't willing to pay for getting that evidence, but they're demanding it.
Besides sharing this information with news people like myself and our listeners, what else do you plan to do with this information? How can it be used?
We're hoping that charities see how the public sees them, because often they don't really have a good sense. They might look at their own organization and do their own polling, but they don't realize that the perceptions of the overall nonprofit sector are not as high as folks might think they would be. The other thing it might do is spur some foundations and wealthy donors to say, this is a real problem. We need to take this on collectively. And that's what some of the experts we talked to said would be a really smart thing to do, is to say, let's all fight this together and prove why charities are valuable.
Well, that will take some organization.
It will indeed.
Stacey Palmer, editor of the Chronicle of Philanthropy, speaking with International Edition Susan Yockey. Coming up, why sitting isn't good for you. This is VOA.
This is Greenbee for a healthier planet.
With a face only a mother could love, this frog and thousands like it are helping farmers in Cambodia as natural pesticides. Basically, they eat the pest that can destroy rice crops.
I first chose to raise frogs on my farm here because in this area we have big problems with harmful insects which can destroy everything.
Rice farmer Rasmal has been raising frogs since 2006.
I used to spend a lot of money, firstly on fertilizer, and secondly on expensive chemical sprays.
Mao's rice yields nearly doubled after he began using frogs to protect his crops against pests. The Cambodia Center for Study and Development of Agriculture promotes the use of frogs as a natural pesticide. But because of widespread frog hunting, most farmers won't raise them. Frogs are a popular and inexpensive food source in Cambodia, so some agriculture experts are urging restrictions on frog hunting during the growing season. I'm Rebecca Ward for VOA's Green Beat.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. Many of us spend far too much time sitting. Not a good idea. It can be a risk factor for a host of diseases, everything from cancer to problems with blood circulation. But the cure is easy. As VOA's Carol Pearson explains, standing up and putting a few new steps into your day can greatly reduce the health risks from sitting.
Michelle Baxter suffers from chronic pain in her muscles and joints. Standing at her desk eases that pain.
My lower lumbar feels much better, and plus I get to exercise and move more, keep everything circulating in the blood. It feels good.
Baxter works at the George Washington University in Washington.
I can get more done. Not even thinking about being stiff and then got to get up and trying to find a place to exercise. So I'm moving. I'm exercising as I'm standing.
As technology increases the amount of time people spend sitting, health experts are becoming more concerned. Studies show that the more we sit, the higher our risk for developing dozens of chronic conditions, from cancer and diabetes to cardiovascular and liver diseases. For older adults, every hour spent sitting is linked to a 50% greater risk of becoming disabled. Jaime Padilla led a study at the University of Missouri to evaluate the harm of too much sitting.
We were surprised by this marked detrimental effects of just 6 hours of sitting on vascular function.
Even after 30 minutes of sitting, your metabolism slows down by 90%. Padilla says sitting reduces blood flow to the legs, and over time, this could lead to cardiovascular disease. Padilla says the researchers also looked at ways to improve employees' health. The simple solution, getting up and walking.
What we found is that 10 minutes of walking at a normal pace, which is equivalent to about 1,000 steps, was sufficient to reverse vascular dysfunction associated with sitting.
A company in Missouri instituted walk breaks and found that it not only helped employees, it helped business.
Employee morale, it's a way for us to spend time together outside of the workplace, and when you're healthier, you're happier.
Health experts say switching to standing desks, adjustable workstations, or even treadmill desks can help. But the key is to get up and walk. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
Nobel Prizes are being awarded. The first was announced Monday in the field of medicine. Scientists from Ireland, Japan, and China were named by the Nobel Committee in Stockholm. William Campbell from Ireland and Satoshi Omura from Japan shared the prize for their discovery of a novel therapy against infections caused by roundworm parasites. China's Tu Youyou discovered a drug that significantly reduced the mortality rates for patients suffering from malaria. So she will also be sharing in the prize. Another big science fiction story is playing at the movies. This one doesn't have the usual phasers or teleporters, but it stars Matt Damon. And that's probably enough to put people in the seats. There are also plenty of special effects, so you can leave your mind at the door. The film is called The Martian, based on a best-selling novel about how man can survive on Mars using just a few tools and some clever math skills. Who better than Matt Damon? Is he up to it? Here's VOA's Penelope Pulu.
At around 4:30 a.m., our satellites detected a storm approaching the Ares 3 mission site on Mars. The storm had escalated to severe, and we had no choice but to abort the mission. But during the evacuation, astronaut Mark Watney was killed.
Except that Mark Watney is very much alive.
This will come as quite a shock to my crewmates. And to NASA. And to the entire world. But I'm still alive. Surprise.
So begins the scientific roller coaster ride chronicling his struggle to survive and NASA's attempts to rescue him. Watney, played by Matt Damon, has supplies for only 31 days.
Here's the rub. It's going to be 4 years for another mission to reach me. And I'm in a hat designed to last 31 days. So I got to make water and grow food on a planet where nothing grows. But if I can't figure out a way to make contact with NASA, then none of this matters anyway.
He succeeds in making contact with NASA, but there is no warp speed here. Watney's ride home is a year away, and he needs food and water.
Luckily,
I'm a botanist. Let's do the math.
That's one of the joys of The Martian, says filmmaker Ridley Scott. Its commitment to scientific accuracy.
It's as near fact as it could possibly be. So the challenges are reality, not fantasy. There's nothing in there that you can't do. There's nothing in there that he uses that isn't already on Mars.
Like a postmodern Robinson Crusoe, Mark Watney uses his ingenuity and intellect to survive.
I guarantee you that at some point, everything's going to go south on you. And you're going to say, this is it. This is how I end. Now, you can either accept that, or you can get to work.
Jim Green, director of Planetary Division at NASA, advised the filmmakers about the terrain and look of Mars. He says movies like The Martian inspire us to keep looking to the stars.
In the 2030s, we're going to be visiting Mars. Humans will be flying by Mars in ways. And then in 2040s and 2050s is when the president wants us to get boots down on the ground.
Green, who recently announced that scientists found liquid water on Mars, says, as in Mark Watney's story, space exploration and survival are in our DNA. Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
That'll do it for this edition of International Edition. You can get more news and information on our website at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. Enjoy the day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S. recently welcomed India to Washington for the first U.S.-India strategic dialogue. Speaking about the dialogue after meeting with Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi in New York, President Barack Obama said, "We've elevated our ties. We've committed ourselves to a new partnership between our two countries." During the strategic dialogue, the U.S. and India discussed how to grow their already strong economic partnership. Annual trade in goods and services between the U.S. and India has grown nearly fivefold since the year 2000 to just over $100 billion. There is potential for that figure to reach more than $500 billion in the years immediately ahead, said U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry. Bilateral trade is also poised to grow substantially, as are employment opportunities for people from both countries. With regard to security matters, U.S.-Indian cooperation continues to grow. Both countries have agreed on a new 10-year defense framework and also on a shared strategic vision for the Asia-Pacific and Indian Ocean that stresses security, maritime law, peaceful resolution of disputes, and economic connectivity across the region. The U.S. is one of India's largest defense suppliers, and both countries are partnering to develop and produce advanced defense systems. On energy, both countries are trying to grow economically in ways that are green and clean. What is clear to everybody, said Secretary Kerry, is that the choices one makes in order to grow green and clean do not mean a choice between growth or the environment. Both can take place simultaneously. Indeed, the U.S. is providing $30 million over 5 years to scale up renewable energy integration into India's power grid. On health, India and the United States are striving to end preventable maternal and child deaths in developing countries. Meanwhile, the U.S. and India have begun a new discussion on oceans conservation and are also building an important partnership in the crucial area of internet governance. Together, said Secretary Kerry, we can help to shape a world that is more secure, peaceful, and prosperous than it was before our efforts came together.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. We'll be right back.
is for...